3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, clap and current hands. Affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Hello and welcome to 3CR Breakfast. You'll note that I'm not your regular host on this Monday. Jackson and James are having a week off, but that's because we can do, we're going to be doing 12 hours of disability content. Well, not us, because we don't want to be on air for 12 hours, but we're doing the breakfast show, which is fortunately is on from 7 to 8:30, and I am joined by two fabulous co-hosts, Larissa McFarland and Naomi Cheney. Yay. Hi guys.
Hi, and we're here with Phineas Mir, in case anyone was wondering who our illustrious host was.
I forgot to introduce myself. That's how well I'm going. My name's Phineas Mir, and let's just start off briefly by saying at 7:02 in the morning, what does disability mean to you guys? What does the International Day of People with a Disability mean to you guys?
Well, good morning, Finn.
Morning.
What does it mean to me this hour in the morning? it's funny, it's weird. Happy International Day of Disability.
Yep.
Happy International Disabled People Day.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's many ways to say it.
Yeah, isn't there?
I was actually just thinking about how I spent 7 years after my brain injury stuck in disability services before I even knew there was a thing such as International Day of People with a Disability. And when I found out, I was a bit excited, but nobody else was. So that was a bit odd to me.
I think for me, like, I didn't know right away either. I mean, like you, my disability is acquired. And I became chronically ill when I was 22. At first I didn't really identify as a person with a disability. So it was a few years before I even kind of got in with that idea. And then I got more involved in community activities, community television specifically related to disability. And, you know, once you're in that sort of sector, it becomes this huge thing. Everybody's doing events and celebrating, and you kind of, yeah. So I guess for me, it's always been about that community.
Yeah.
And I think there's a history that isn't so much about that, you know, where it was more, I think you were saying earlier, Larissa, that it was more about sort of organisations, more about government, more about,
yeah, because when I first learnt about the day, I was really excited, and I thought this was a great opportunity for the community to come together and identify and be positive. And so the following year I decided to make some sort of banner to tell the world, because obviously the world didn't know about this day.
Mm.
And then I discovered that the logo had changed from this sort of cute little character with crazy hair to this sort of armless and legless figure. And I was a bit sort of affronted, because that's when I realised that somebody else out there was making decisions about International Day, and that I wasn't, and my friends and I weren't actually part of that decision making. So I was a little bit miffed at that point.
I'd agree with that. I think that Disability Day is unfortunately more is really not for us as people with disability or disabled people. It's more for service providers or for people that want to say that they're very good at providing services or looking out for the needs of disabled people rather than us. And is it a day, I guess my question is it a day we need to reclaim?
Well, obviously, because we're here. In fact, that's the only reason I am here.
That's what we're doing today.
Yeah, right. Because International Day for me has always been about organisations and governments and the UN, and there's been very few disability-led events, and that's always been really sad to me. So I've always wanted to take part in those disability-led things, and it is amazing that 3CR is doing that, having this disability-led 12 hours of programming.
And everyone who's hosting a program today will be a person with a disability as well. We very much wanted it to be nothing about us without us kind of on 3CR today.
And yeah. And there'll also be a range of voices with disabilities as well. Hopefully today will, for people who are listening, will show the diversity of the disability voice. Now, I'm going to go seamlessly into, just segue nicely into what 3CR Breakfast does all the time, which is looking at the newspapers. And so we're doing it in a slightly different way in that we're looking at disability content for International Day of People with a Disability. And there has been, well, there's paltry, it's been a bit paltry in the papers, would we say?
Yeah, I'd agree paltry is the right word there. So I had a bit of a look through the papers this morning. So it was the Age, the Herald Sun, and the Australian, and the Australian failed entirely. I could not at a glance see anything in there that was even remotely disability related.
Oh.
The Herald Sun won on number of articles in that they had two articles. One of which was about a man whose wheelchair was stolen in Fed Square. This is a bad Santa nabs wheelchair. So the guy was wearing a Santa hat while he stole a wheelchair. So that's a lovely heartwarming story there.
It's pretty appalling.
It's incredibly appalling.
But we should also thank the Herald Sun because, or the Herald Sun should thank the person who did steal the wheelchair because it's up their disability content today by 50%.
They're now the winners because of that.
Yeah, good for them. What do we think? So there was that article. What else was it?
So the other was about a man named Josh who has become a paraplegic in an accident about a year ago. And the story is very much about him regaining his fitness. So he's been going to the gym and sort of getting back on his feet. Mm. And it's, I'd describe it as maybe inspiration porn, if people are familiar with that term at home.
What is inspiration porn?
Yeah, tell us.
What is inspiration porn? So I think if you want the details, I think go look up Stella Young on YouTube because she's done some really amazing videos where she's gone into it in more detail than we have time for.
Hang on. We're encouraging people to go to YouTube and not listen to us. What's with that?
Later on.
But stay with us now.
But give people – can we give people a bit of a definition of what inspiration porn is?
Yeah. So basically it's when there are stories about people with disabilities that are designed to inspire able-bodied people to a degree. Like, say, you know, the disabled person did a thing, which, you know, I mean, getting fit at the gym is something that a lot of people do all the time, but we don't make a big deal of it because they're not paraplegic.
And it's also, I think, about making the able-bodied person general, they're inspiring stories, but they're also stories that make people, able-bodied people, feel better about themselves.
Or even, like, it's almost like, what's your excuse to able-bodied people? Like, that person can do it. Why aren't you getting off your butt and doing it too? Like, it's to get able-bodied people moving, I guess, So it's stories that are about disabled people, but for able-bodied people.
Is that because disabled people can't move? Is that the idea there?
I suppose the opposite of being the inspiration is that you're the tragedy and that, you know, you're an object of pity.
Now,
and it sort of leads to it being more inspirational when you do very ordinary things, I guess, is where that pity narrative kind of ends up. It's related.
Now, there was an article in The Age as well.
There was. So this one was about an actor. So, Finn, I might let you... tell us a little bit about what you know about this particular actor.
Well, all I know is he has an acquired brain injury, I believe, and has been acting and was in a MTT performance of The Curious Case of the Elephant Man, I think was the name of it. It was based on the life of the Elephant Man, and that's pretty much all I know about Daniel. But what was the story about?
Basically, it's just about an actor who is being an actor. It's the headline is "Actor Proves Disabled Is Not Unable." So basically, he has successfully been an actor while disabled.
So that's kind of ableist, isn't it?
I think it's along the same lines as the "Yay, we went to the gym." I mean, becoming an actor, a lot of people aspire to that, obviously, and becoming famous and sort of, you know, rubbing arms with Hollywood elite, which is what sort of what this article is really about. It's a big thing, but I think it's, you know, I mean, the headline itself really implies that we don't expect disabled people to be able to do this. He's proved something important by proving that he is not unable to do this.
To be an actor.
To be successful at his job. So I think there's a vibe there where you would not speak this way about an able-bodied actor, basically.
Well, and that's pretty. I mean, that's what I wonder why. I mean, why does the media continue to perpetrate this narrative of people with disabilities, do we think?
I think it's easy. I think it's very surface. I mean, as a disabled person, what I would prefer to see would be something that challenged systemic beliefs in society. You know, where are we failing disabled people? Where do we need to improve? You know, I mean, obviously we're on 3CR, we're talking, radical politics here, but I think, it's a bit disappointing that it's actors and people going to the gym.
If we can bring it back to, International Day, just to tie it back in for a minute, is there a way we'd like to see, if there are going to be media stories on disability, particularly today, and if the UN is going to focus on us, how would we like to see us portrayed?
Larissa, do you have any ideas?
I think as people.
As people.
As humans.
Yeah, that's a good start.
Like, it's sadly lacking in that, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, it's, there's the objectification. But, I'd like to see a lot more... we're talking today about major protests and things that have been going on around the world. Like, there's so many things that people with disabilities are doing to try and change their lives and fight for their rights. Today is about choices and rights. And the media could do a lot more to focus on that, I think.
And I think also, is there a role, I guess, because the UN sees itself as, raising awareness of issues. I think that there is a role for... awareness raising in Disability Day, and that is really only to highlight the disability in the developed world and poverty and disability. I think that they're issues which could be focused on from a UN point of view.
And who does a really good job of focusing on the choices and rights?
Johnny Crescendo.
Johnny Crescendo.
We should hear him right now. It is 3CR Breakfast on Disability Day. You're with Larissa, Phineas and Naomi. And... if you want an SMS, you can SMS us right now on 0488808095. That's 0488809855. And at 7:17, it's time to introduce our first guest.
Yes, our first guest is Nicole Lee, who is a survivor advocate working in family violence. Nicole, good morning.
Hey, how you going?
Great. It's really good to have you here today on International Day of People with a Disability.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So you've been passionately advocating for survivors of family violence for some time now. Can you tell us how you got involved in that?
Okay, so I lived through 10 years of violence. I think that there's quite a lot of people out there that are aware of my story now. So I survived 10 years of abuse and sexual assault at the hands of my partner, who was also my carer. And just as I was coming out of that, Victoria was going into a Royal Commission at that time. And so I was able to, I was invited and able to give evidence at the Royal Commission as a lay witness. So it was the first time I'd been able to speak openly and publicly about those 10 years of abuse. From there, I've been on a couple of different government boards and committees where I get to advocate to government on the reforms that were proposed by the Royal Commission. Until more recently, myself and my one of my friends and fellow advocates, Doreen Chawla, decided to run in the state election for the upper house.
Yes, we might get to that, because that's pretty exciting. I just should let listeners know that you're at the airport right now.
Yes, which is why I am at the airport right now.
We can hear some announcements in the background.
Yes, it's a bit noisy here. Sorry about that, guys.
That's all right. So can you tell us a bit about the prevalence of violence against people with disabilities, and particularly women? Like, what are the statistics?
Well, the statistics we know for sexual assault is, which is the one that's quoted quite regularly, but it's the 90% of women with an intellectual disability have or will be sexually assaulted in their lifetime.
It's appalling. 70%, it's such a shocking statistic.
We need to do more research into that statistic to find out the extent of that within Australia. So I will point out that's an older study and research that was done, and it's well overdue.
And that was just, I think we might have talked over the stat there. That was not 90% of women with disabilities will experience domestic violence?
Women with an intellectual disability.
Women with an intellectual disability, yeah. And 40%, and so you're three times more likely. So 40% of women with a physical disability or intellectual disability will experience family violence. That's pretty high.
Yeah.
That's a pretty high rate.
Yeah. Can you tell us some of the reasons why people with disabilities are at greater risk, why these statistics are higher?
Well, I know for myself, and the thing that I'm advocating quite strongly for, is that we keep hearing people talk about people with disabilities and them being vulnerable. It's not necessarily a matter of the individual and the vulnerability being placed on them. We continuously, as a society, build a system and put people with disabilities in situations that make them vulnerable.
Yeah.
So we're constantly, if you've ever been for an NDIS planning meeting or review meeting, they're constantly looking for informal support. So carers, parents, family members that can do the day-to-day looking after and support of somebody with a disability. Now, that leaves us very open and vulnerable to that person's behaviour. So it's not the individual, it's the situation society keeps putting us in. So if you put somebody, you're essentially at the mercy of this individual as to how they do and do not wish to treat you. I'm not saying everybody is disability, but there's people out there that do. And we need to find ways in which to stop that from happening and empower people to be independent and in their own right without needing informal care. Or if somebody does need informal care, it shouldn't come at the expense of an intimate partner or family members, that we all have a right to be free from those very binding, disempowering connections that they that can turn into.
What supports are available for people who are experiencing domestic violence?
Well, there's a family violence system that's meant to be able to support people with a disability, but it's a matter of finding a way to those supports for someone with a disability. So the NDIS should be able to provide you with all the home supports you need without relying on an individual. I guess I was very lucky that I came into the NDIS after I left my relationship and not beforehand. So,
can you elaborate there what you mean about why the NDIS makes it difficult?
Well, the NDIS is creating more barriers and creating a system where we're still remaining stuck. So I had been still living with my ex-husband. He would have taken over all of the coordinating of my care and the handling of my funds, and I would not have asked or even felt that I could have asked with him around that I needed care coordination or financial intermediary for somebody else external to help me with those sorts of things. So he would have taken over control of all of those aspects of my NDIS plan, and I still would have remained stuck.
Mm. What would you say they can do to change this?
I think a really important one is to, when you're going for a planning meeting or a review meeting, is to be doing that with the individual, without you know, the carer can be there for part of it, but asking the carer to maybe step out of the room and talk to them face, you know, one-to-one. If somebody has, you know, grown up, you know, as a child and been looked after by their parents, at a certain age that maybe care coordination should be an automatic given for a young adult, sort of moving out of that dynamic with their parents where they need to be, you know, they want to grow up to be an individual in their own right. And giving them the opportunity in which to explore and find those options that, you know, they don't have to ask for, that they should just be automatically, you know, offered and supplied to someone, versus the person having to somehow speak up for something that they've never been able to speak up for before in their lifetime.
What can the NDIS do to change, to make it easier for people to, if you are experiencing domestic violence, what can they do to make it easy for people to access the support they need to be independent of the partner?
Well, when somebody, when a violent situation and a relationship has been identified, but an automatic, like within a couple of days review of somebody's plan needs to happen, and we know that that doesn't happen and it can't possibly happen. But when you're leaving a violent relationship, you need extra support. Extra support workers or carers that are to be put in place. So that means you need access to funds. And so, yeah, immediate reviews of somebody's plan needs to happen in an emergency. And I don't feel that that's happening at the moment. It's, yeah, it's definitely not happening at the moment.
What type of, if someone is in crisis, is there enough, are there enough supports that people, women with disabilities in particular, can access?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because the support industry is, I know for myself, I can't speak for all, you know, all the areas, but I know for myself, when trying to access workers through my agency, sometimes it can be really difficult. There's just not enough workers to go around for the demands that people need. So it's a massive, massive gap in the system right there.
Yeah.
What about the people working within, I guess, as service providers? Do they need to be more attuned to the needs of people experiencing domestic violence?
Absolutely. Yeah, you think the amount and the level in which we interact with support workers and staff and the health system and mental health system, like I know for myself, mental health system, and for abuse to be going on for such a long time, and all of these people that are coming into my home and that I'm interacting with, that none of these people did anything about the signs and things that they were seeing. So we need to train our support staff in identifying signs of abuse and warning signs, give them actual places to go to rather than just back to the agency, and make them accountable for the holistic care of an individual, that you're not just there to help them shower and get groceries or, you know, clean, you know, help them clean their house or, you know, day-to-day living things. You're also there to support this person in an overall holistic sense. So, yeah, they do need to be more attuned and given better training, as well as places to go to when somebody is facing abuse as well. We can't just tell people that you need to look out for signs and then, well, we actually don't know what you need to do with those signs. They need supported pathways in order to help that person that is currently facing violence.
One of the things that I've really noticed through my own experience with disability services is just the lack of gender awareness, just full stop, let alone violence, just awareness that that women experiencing things differently in disability services and need gender-sensitive services. There still seems to be a long way to go with that. Do you think that's why, the statistics you mentioned, the prevalence of violence against women is so great. Why do you think it's still so unknown? Or is it just another part of the whole system?
I think it's just another part of the whole system. And we struggle to comprehend that violence can happen to able-bodied women, yeah. let alone when you start bringing in complexities as well. It makes people uncomfortable is usually what I find when I talk about the abuse that I've experienced, is that it makes people really uncomfortable. Because most people could never see themselves doing anything like that. So then when you hear about that happening to someone with a disability, you just think that's completely and utterly abhorrent. We need to get past that level of uncomfortable, or we actually need to face the uncomfortable in those conversations to be able to address, you know, why this is continuing to happen.
Okay.
Will we? Sadly, we're running out of time.
Well, I was going to actually segue from that uncomfortable, the fact that people, we struggle so much hearing about violence. We've got a 3-minute extract of a longer 10-minute speech that was made by Senator Jordan Steele-John in the Parliament back in September. And this is where he listed the names of people with disabilities who've died in care through abuse and neglect. It's a pretty big listen, and so we're only playing 3 minutes of it, I want to reassure, because then we might talk about, he also calls for, he and many people have been calling for a Royal Commission, and... So should we have a listen to that, Finn?
Yeah. We should, yes. Let's listen to that.
Great.
Stay on the line with us.
Ponting, 33, died after being left unsupervised in a bathtub for an extended period of time. His carers were blamed for negligence. Darren Kingmar died in his respite facility as a result of an unexplained incident in which he broke his neck. He was left on the floor for over an hour after his support workers gave up trying to pull him up, saying that he was being non-compliant. David Veach, Miriam Merton, a mother of two who was left naked and covered in feces at a Lismore psychiatric hospital. Amanda Gilbert, 47, who had a required brain injury as a result of attempted suicide and was placed in the Greylands Psychiatric Care Centre in my home state of WA. She was raped and assaulted 111 times and died as a result of complications used in the medication to sedate her. The WA coroner believes this to have been an underestimation of the number of times that she was raped. Elizabeth Floyd died when a pressure sore she had received at her care home became septic. The inquest heard about serious issues in the facility that she lived. Julia Jacobson, a 51-year-old amputee who died a preventable, avoidable death after a private disability support provider withdrew essential supports. Sandra Deacon, 55. Janice and Robin Fakura, 68 and 50. A family friend of the three people died in a shooting near Harvey Bay and says it was a mercy killing. Cheryl Thompson, Janet Makuzahi, Julie fucking hell, Julie Betty Cunn, 81-year-old from Armadale, charged over his elderly partner's apparent mercy killing. Described it as a beautiful act of mercy for his wife. These are the names that don't get spoken. These are the reasons. These are the human beings. These are the loved ones, the mothers, the fathers, the sons, the partners, who need justice, who demand justice, whose lives were worth living, in whose memory I tonight wear a white flower, and whose passing
fills me with an ironclad determination. I will not stop, I will not rest, until they find the justice that is so desperately owed them.
And we're here on 3CR Breakfast on International Day of People with a Disability, and that was Senator Jordan Steele John speaking in Parliament on the 18th of September. And, yeah, he was listing some of the people who have died since... In 2015, there was a Senate inquiry that recommended a Royal Commission into the disability sector, which hasn't happened, but he was listing then some of the people that have died, and it's a pretty hard listen. Nicole, you're still with us. Thank you. Why do you think that we need a Royal Commission into the abuse and neglect of people with disabilities?
Well, we can't address something that we don't know the full extent of and what's causing it. So we need to uncover how deep the abuse and the neglect runs and what is currently failing people and putting people in these situations where they do get abused and neglected. A Royal Commission needs to look into our mental health systems, supported disability accommodation, down to the care support systems for people, individuals living in their own homes as well. I mean, it's integral. We can't address something that we don't know the full extent of, and that's pretty much the crux of it.
What do you think? The Senate inquiry listed a number of recommendations, one of which was that the need to have a Royal Commission. Well, why do you think that the need for it has fallen on deaf ears?
I think we've had a bit of trouble with our federal government in general for many, many years now. But I still am perplexed constantly as to why the lives of people with a disability don't seem to warrant the necessary action that we keep calling for. And maybe this is purely because we're not in positions of leadership and power within this country. That we've got the senator in WA with a disability, and we've got other individuals scattered around the country who are making their way into Parliament or have been over the years. But ultimately, we're not in the major decision makings, and we should be in the Parliament, which is one of the reasons why I ran with my friend Tarang, is that we need proper representation in these decision-making roles so that things don't get overlooked, so that we don't have to be reading out an appalling list of abuse and neglect and murder in the Parliament, begging for somebody to do something and take action. And it's not good enough, and there is no excuse for why they haven't done anything.
People talk about it. Is there a need to? Is the Royal Commission the best way we can do that, or is there another means of doing it?
There's potentially other means, but I think a Royal Commission makes it open and it's transparent as well. And it's not completely controlled by the government as well. So we could look into, I know there's heaps of Productivity Commission reports into the NDIS and Joint Standing Committee reports, and we could be doing a massive review of all the literature we have to date whilst we wait for a Royal Commission. And the states could be doing this whilst we wait for and keep advocating to the federal government to implement a Royal Commission. So there are things that I honestly feel that we could be doing that, I just don't understand why we're not. We as a community need to maybe get more vocal, maybe band together and be a greater force that the government can't ignore moving forward into the future. I can't think of other ways in which to do it.
I must say I was a little bit... Because I feel like we've been talking about this Royal Commission for so long now, since 2015 we've been calling for it, since that Senate inquiry, and when the government recently has started this Royal Commission into aged care, and we called for that to be extended to include disability care, I was quite surprised that there was an opportunity there to do something and they didn't.
Yeah.
It does really feel like there's this complete sort of, let's not look at this at all. It's quite... incredible.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder, and this is just my own personal opinion, is that, you know, the NDIS and the government relies so massively on informal carers, so yeah. that if we were to fully uncover the abuse of people with a disability, it means that we're going to have to stop relying on informal carers, which is going to cost them money. Now, that's probably, I don't know whether this is a really poor judgment on my behalf, but, you know, I honestly believe that it comes down to they're afraid of having to take on the responsibility or that this is going to cost more. And our lives are not dollar-sized. Our lives are worth more than simply funding. And if it's going to cost more, you give us freedom and independence, and that's what it has to cost. And they can just stop dragging their heels in it. But maybe I'm wrong with that assessment, but I think that's got to be part of blame.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you've ever been in an NDIS planning meeting and they ask you, so what about your informal support? Has anything changed since last time? And it's very disempowering to sit there and say to someone, I don't have any friends who will come over and help me clean my house. So no, stop looking for something that's not there. Stop trying to make somebody else responsible for what is essentially your responsibility to support me.
And that was the intention of the NDIS all along,
yeah.
wasn't it? You know, it was about providing choices for disabled people and to empower them to actually control their own lives and their own funding.
Yeah, exactly. I'll go back to some of I read some of the speeches that Bruce Bonahaney gave back in the early days of talking about and trying to get the NDIS up and running, was that it wasn't meant to be empowering choice and control, no longer relying on family members. You could go back to having everyday relationships with your mum, your dad, and your children, your partners. And that's not how it's turning out to be. And the more and more I go into the NDIS, the more it feels like they're trying to cut corners and cost saving, and they're looking at ways in which they can, you know, reduce my funding, which, it's not the insurance principle. It's not what it was meant to be. And it's incredibly disappointing and disheartening. Now, in saying that, for people who weren't on an individual support package, the NDIS is definitely a lot better than what I had before. I don't have the massive gap funding with equipment, but it needs to be done so much better. We had an opportunity to give people freedom, and we're falling short on it, and that's not good enough.
Well, I think we're fast running out of time, but if people want to find out, I guess, so what would, as a final note, what any advice you'd give to people with disabilities listening, either who are experiencing domestic violence or disability abuse out there, what advice would you give them?
For one thing, which was something that I used to tell myself, is that this is not, because these are the things you're told by people, is that this is not your fault. You are not a burden. And, you know, you don't have to be grateful because you want to live and you want to be able to get out of bed in the morning, but you don't deserve the things that are being said to you and done to you. And find somebody outside of the house, someone, anyone that you can confide in safely as well. Find ways in which to talk to, say, a GP where the person isn't in the room. And also, Women's Disability Australia have released an app called Sunny, which looks promising in that it's got an easy-to-read keyboard and you can start to tell your story. So if you don't have the ability to communicate, you can tell your story of abuse via this, in which to show other people as well, which I think is a really good resource that's just been developed.
Fantastic. Well, very salient points there, Nicole. Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. We hope we haven't made you late for your flight.
No, I'm all good. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Enjoy the rest of the day, too.
Cheers. Thanks, Nicole. That is Nicole Lee, domestic violence survivor and passionate disability advocate. Now, I think we're going to go to a community service announcement. We'll be back straight after these.
Hi, I'm Svetlana. You are listening to 3CR Radio. Be respect to brain injury women and at all women.
Mental illness has a bit of a hard gig, I think, in all forms, and I think that I suppose it's about saying accepting difference and accepting different behaviour and accepting difference in other people. I suppose within the disability sector, is there a hierarchy of disability? I don't know. Are there judgmental attitudes in the disability sector itself? I don't know. But I just know that mental illness, because it's an invisible disability, because you can't see the broken brain that produces the behaviour that we show sometimes, because it's an invisible illness and an invisible disability, it's hard for people to accept that we have an illness and that we have a disability. So even if in the own sector, it's about people accepting us for who we are. And generally speaking, society doesn't deal with difference at all well. So how do we break down those barriers and say to a wider society, it's about accepting difference in all its manifestations. And because I have a mental illness, you know, I have a different difference.
Hello, you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on Disability Day, not another bloody morning. T, that's the name of our show. If you want to SMS in, you can do so by calling 0488 809 855. That's 0488 809 855. That's the SMS line. Now, fortunately, it's time to go to our next guest, who just happens to be in the studio.
Yay, yeah. Our next guest is Naomi Chaney.
So I'm doubling up today as sort of a host and a guest right
now. Yeah.
And organiser and just, you know, all-round amazing person.
Damn straight.
Thank you. You're probably going to be hearing a bit from Naomi today.
Yes, I'll be on and off the radio all day, yes.
Yeah.
We apologise in advance.
thanks, Ben.
Anytime. No.
They know each other well. They're allowed to say things like
yes,
that.
We go way back.
We do. Sorry. Now, what are we talking to Naomi about?
So, yeah, our next topic of conversation is what's known as the DSP, the Disability Support Pension, which is a topic of conversation for many people, actually. And, Naomi, we know that the Gillard government tightened the criteria for the DSP, but how has applying for the DSP been made more difficult under the current government?
So I wanted to kind of get at that the Gillard government did actually tighten the criteria to get onto the payment. So where previously a lot of people had been on the payment for a long time, there was suddenly a period in 2012 where quite a few people were sort of unceremoniously kicked off.
We should just explain what the DSP is for those that may not know.
Yeah, probably should.
Ah, yes, okay. So the disability support pension is there for people with disabilities who are unable to work. And it's basically a living pension so that you can pay your bills and the rent and such. Groceries, that sort of thing, is what that's intended for. So it's different to the NDIS, not to be confused with that sort of funding, which is more about providing supports for people who need those. This is more about just everyday living costs. So people may qualify for the DSP and the NDIS, or one or the other, depending on their circumstances.
Yeah, and the DSP comes to you via Centrelink.
It does, yes.
So often people are on Newstart or sickness benefits for a while, and then if they're lucky, are accepted onto the DSP.
Yep.
I should say that the DSP, the amount that you get, means that you're still living way below the poverty line.
Yes, yeah. And it's similar to the age pension in the amount that you receive from the DSP. So in 2012, the criteria was tightened so that it was more difficult to get onto the DSP. So there's a lot of people who came off the disability pension at that time who, you know, still can't necessarily work and are now on Newstart, which is, you know, creates a lot of issues. People are asked to look for work when they can't necessarily actually do work. So this is an issue. But I guess this is sort of old news. This is back in 2012, but I kind of want to get at what the current government has actually done to make the process more difficult to get onto the DSP. So previously when you applied, there would be a form there that you would give to your doctor, and there were very straightforward questions on this form. You know, some of them were yes or no questions or multiple choice, or they would ask for a little bit more detail, but it was very structured And doctors would be able to fill that out in a fairly straightforward way. Now what they do is they just ask you to get a report from your doctor, but they don't give these very specific questions that they still want the answers to. The exact same questions, they've just taken them out of the application process. So we have a situation now where doctors really need to have done their research. And for a disabled person, it's really about the luck of, you know, how much dedication your doctor has to this. And doctors are not obligated. There is nothing that says that a doctor has to know about all the Centrelink requirements before they can do their job. You know, it's not the central part of their job. A lot of them don't have time. You know, there's a lot of time constraints on the way that the medical system is set up for doctors in the first place. So you need to have an extra committed doctor to actually even know how to make a report like this in the first place.
The reports that the doctors need to make, I think they get a special item number for probably doing this sort of report, but in no way reflects really the amount of work that they need to do a good report.
Yeah, and there's quite in-depth research that you actually need to do. So there's quite specific questions. They need to say that the condition is fully treated, that it is stabilised and fully diagnosed. And these terms can mean something a little bit different to Centrelink than they do to a lot of doctors.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the word stabilised. This is very flexible in meaning with the way that Centrelink uses it, because if you have a remitting relapsing condition, a doctor may not consider that stable as such. Or if you are deteriorating, your condition is deteriorating, they may not consider that stable.
Technically, it's not stable if you're deteriorating.
Technically, it's not. I think the doctors have the right of it here. But, you know, Centrelink has created this situation where, you know, it's ostensibly in there because they don't want to put someone on the DSP who is going to recover. You know, that doesn't make sense, obviously. But, you know, in doing so, they've actually made it not very clear on the wording, and if a doctor does not get this wording right, then someone can be rejected for the payment even though they are deteriorating, or, you know, whatever the case may be.
So the onus therefore comes back on the person with a disability to prove they have a disability.
Yeah, I mean, this has always been the case, but I suppose it's this is an unnecessary barrier that they've put up. This is very political. This, you know, there was a questionnaire there that is no longer there. Which did streamline the process. It made it much more straightforward for doctors. They could do it much more quickly. So it's basically, you know, it's get rid of that form. How much money are we going to save by people who just don't know how to do this? And you've got to remember, people with disabilities, this includes people with intellectual disabilities. This includes people with communication problems.
People with brain injuries.
People with memory problems.
Yeah,
like this creates an enormous barrier for people in these situations who can't self-advocate in the doctor's office. And it's, you know, we've actually seen that the number of people going onto the DSP is going down dramatically. This is working in terms as a money saving venture.
Am I right in saying that the government had a sort of criteria, and then that criteria was found to be flawed, and so people that were previously rejected for payment can now potentially go back on it, or is that not fully correct?
If that's the case, I'm not aware of it, I'll be honest.
Okay.
But I won't definitely say that wasn't the case, because if it was a story, then I've missed it. But I think, I mean, you do see in the news a lot of the time, this person who very clearly needs to be on the DSP was not, and it becomes a personal story about how, and you think maybe it's someone who slipped through the cracks, that somebody at Centrelink made a mistake. A lot of the staff at Centrelink are not trained. They don't have the training that they need in order to process a lot of these things accurately as well. So that's a separate issue in and of itself.
But
I was just going to make a comment about Centrelink, which is, you know, totally not relevant. I was going to say, I still can't believe that when you go to Centrelink, you still have to line up in a queue and you have to stand and there aren't seats. Like, it's just still mind-boggling.
I've had a bit to do with Centrelink over the years, and I have chronic fatigue syndrome. I can't stand in those lines.
Yeah.
I literally have to drag a seat over for myself and then drag the seat with me as I move up the line. Like, this is... and this is, you know, I'm someone who can actually walk around sometimes, so it's an issue of, you know, it's not very well thought out at all.
So is the process discriminatory for people who have, say, chronic fatigue syndrome or other conditions which may not be easily sort of diagnosed?
I think one of the things that I've sort of noticed on the tables is that there's not a specific table for chronic pain. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that I know who have maybe serious back pain issues who are really going to struggle to fit anywhere into this table, even though, you know, if your back's stuffed up, like, a lot of people are going to really struggle to work with that. If you've got chronic pain that has you on the floor unexpectedly at different times of the day, like, it's really, really hard to hold down a job. So that's one thing. It's just the lack of a table on that. Yeah, I think I've spoken to you before about this, Finn. I have chronic fatigue syndrome, so the most logical thing for me would be the table that is related to fatigue. And I just want to read this out because this is to get the DSP, you need to get 20 points in one of the tables or across a few tables. And there's complicated system there, which I won't go into in any more detail. But I'll just read this out. If your disability is related to fatigue, then if there is a severe functional impact on the activities requiring physical exertional stamina, if the person is able to walk or mobilize in a wheelchair from the car park into a shopping center or supermarket without assistance. So basically, if you can use a wheelchair to get across a car park, then you don't have enough points to get onto the DSP. However, the exact same wording is used for people who have impairment of the lower limbs. And if they can get across a car park with a wheelchair, but they need help getting in and out of the wheelchair, then they actually do qualify with 20 points in that table. So it's like literally exactly the same wording, except that one group can use a wheelchair and the other one can't.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
Clarifying that, yeah. That's just completely sort of...
And this is what I mean, like the tables, you know, and there are other sort of inconsistencies like that in there. That's just the one that I noticed because, you know, I particularly was focused on the fatigue table. But it's... Yeah, I mean, you can see immediately there's a level of discrimination there, and it's the same. Like, I mean, there's tables for things like cognitive function and mental illness, and it's just a slightly different standard for all the different sort of ways that you can be impaired. And so it's not a consistent sort of realistic view of how impairment works, I don't think.
Where did you find these tables? Are they available online?
They are available online. You do have to search for them. So, if you want to look for, Centrelink impairment tables or disability impairment tables, you can Google them and they'll come up. Again, these tables are very crucial to the way that you do your application for the DSP. You have to address the tables, but they're not in the application process. You have to actually have done the research. And this is what I mean. They've created these barriers where you need to know to look for this.
Mm-hmm.
It's available, but you need to know in advance to look for it and then be able to understand it.
So I'm also thinking about the problem that if you were able to look for them and find them and then go to your GP and say, here's these tables, you need to address this. I personally have had an experience where, with several GPs, where I have basically been rejected because I am seen as too assertive, or I'm asking for too much, or I'm being too demanding.
You're telling them how to do their job.
And they really don't like being told what to do.
And I think there's a lot more motivation for the person with the disability to actually research this stuff. You know, it affects their ability to buy groceries and pay rent and pay their bills. For the doctor, they don't have this personal incentive. For them, it's about professional pride. So I think there's a very different motivation, which can mean that the disabled person is actually more educated on it because they're more highly motivated to look into this.
So just finally, what can listeners do to make the process easier or to complain about the DSP, being discriminatory?
I think support for advocacy and rights organisations is really important. I've personally spoken to Social Security Rights Victoria when going through helping people with reviews, and I'm on the DSP myself, and I was reviewed recently, and they were incredibly helpful. very good at clarifying what information was needed, so, and providing like a sample report that can help you, you know, figure out where you fit into it with your particular needs and conditions. And I think just, you know, write to your MP. Like, this needs to be on the agenda. I mean, we were talking before with Nicole about how this just is not on anyone's agenda. And we've got an election coming up. Like, we could make this a real topic for discussion if we wanted to as a wider population.
Yeah, there's actually there's a few new DSP petitions, as one particular going around at the moment about the DSP that's just been started by some people with disabilities. So look out for those. And I just want to give one more bit of advice, is that if you are being reviewed, don't go alone. Don't go to the appointment alone. Take someone with you.
It's always good to have a reference.
Particularly because they're more likely to be realistic about the way you live your life. Because we tend to see it in different ways, yeah. And Centrelink needs to hear.
Fantastic.
Most.
Well, I think we've got to wrap up our disability support pension discussion. I'm sure Centrelink will be very disappointed in that because they're going to get that. They're going to get this transcript because I've just mentioned the word Centrelink. It is.
Hey, thanks, Naomi, for that. That was really great.
Thanks for coming in, Naomi.
Most of the time, if you call up and say, is this place accessible for a person in a wheelchair, or is it accessible for a person with a vision impairment or other disabilities, most of the time they would say yes, and most of the time the venue is not accessible because they don't know what accessible is.
Hello, and we're back. It is 3CR Breakfast. As part of the Disability Day broadcast, we're choosing our rights and control. Now, Larissa, you've got some feedback from our listeners.
Yeah, just on, in response to our this discussion we just had on the DSP, the Disability Support Pension, we have had an SMS just thanking us for that and asking us if we can recommend a service to call to get some help because they've said they haven't got any help from the Department of Human Services. So Naomi did suggest Social Security Rights Victoria as a good advocacy organisation that she used when she had her review recently. So hopefully it's helpful.
Fantastic. No more listener feedback?
No.
Okay. Well, at 3 minutes past eight, it's time to introduce our next guest. But I'll give you an introduction. The NDIS is a new way for Australians with disabilities under 65 to get support and care. It has the capacity to changed the lives of about 460,000 people with disabilities. Once fully rolled out in 2020, Kirsten Dean, director of Every Australian Counts or Each, joins us to talk about how the NDIS is working. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, Finn. Thanks for having me today.
Not a problem. Now, Each or Every Australian Counts has been working on, has conducted a series of NDIS Make It Work forums. What have these forums told you about how the NDIS, told you about the NDIS participant experience?
Yeah, thanks, Finn. So Every Australian Counts is the grassroots organisation that fought for the introduction of the National Disability Insurance Scheme. And it's funny, usually when people campaign for something and they win, they usually all go yay and all go home. But actually Every Australian Counts has been stayed really engaged with how the NDIS is rolling out. Because it's rolling out over such a long period of time and it's such a big, complicated reform, we've stayed really engaged with, you know, its progress. So at the moment, what we're doing is we're holding community forums all around the country. We've held 19 of them so far in every state and territory. And we're bringing together people with disability, families, people who work in the sector to talk about what's going well with the NDIS and what do we want to see more of, but perhaps more importantly, what's not going well and what do we want to see change. And so what we found at those forums, there's a set of things that are common no matter where you are all across the country that people are telling us, and then there's always a few things that are just very specific to the place that we've been. So the most common things that we hear from people with disability and their families is that the NDIS is too complicated, it's too complex, it's too bureaucratic, it's too hard to navigate. And people are really on their own trying to navigate their way through. And as a result, some people aren't getting the support that they really need and other people are missing out altogether. And so we really want that to change.
How can that change?
So what we're doing at the forums, one of the things we're doing is that we invite local MPs along to every forum because we want them to hear directly from the people that they're elected to represent about what they want to see from the NDIS, because we hear a lot from Polly's about the NDIS, and we also hear from the National Disability Insurance Agency that runs the NDIS, but we think the people that matter most are the people with disability and their families. And so we want them, the Polly's, to hear directly from people with disability and their families about when the scheme works. It works really well, and it really does change people's lives, and we shouldn't ever lose sight of that. But it's not working well for everyone. And so what we've got to do is put the pressure on our politicians who are elected to represent us to get the scheme that we fought for in the first place, to make sure that it really does work well for people with disability and their families, and that it really delivers on the promise that it made all those years ago. So the purpose of the forums is everyone to get together and sort of, take a temperature check and kind of see what's working and what's not, and then really send a message to the police that we want them to roll up their sleeves and get these problems sorted out.
Are there people who are going to be worse currently or going to be worse off with the current DSP, the current NDIS, the way it is?
Yeah, that's a really awful part of the forums, actually, Finn, because it's really, really heartbreaking to hear about people who are worse off, because that's never what we wanted kind of in the first place. So there's probably a few groups of people who are not faring well under the NDIS, and we hear a lot about people who have very complex needs and they're not faring well under the NDIS. People who come from a culturally or linguistically diverse background, people who come from an Aboriginal or a Torres Strait Islander background, people who have a psychosocial disability or a mental illness, they're not faring well under the NDIS. And I have to say, and also pretty much people who don't have anyone in their corner, who don't have a family member or don't have an advocate or don't have someone who's on their team who's in there helping them with the process, they're not, because it's so complicated, they're not faring well under the NDIS. And so they're particular groups of people. But honestly, we hear a lot from people who, you know, who come to our forums and say, I'm really well educated, I'm really well resourced, I've had lots of advantages and I'm finding it really hard too, and I'm not getting the support that I need. And so they're the groups of people that we hear most commonly aren't faring well, but everybody is really struggling with how complicated it is.
So the planning process, you've talked about the complexity there. What about if people are, once they get their plan, how can they go about getting it reviewed?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things in there, Finn. One is that people tell us they want help at every stage of the process because it is so complicated. So they want more help before they go in, so they know what they're walking into, they know what process is involved, they know what questions they're going to ask, so they have a bit of a time to think about it before they go in. Then they want help during the planning process, and then particularly, people say this most commonly, that they want help afterwards, because at the moment they feel like they just get this NDIS plan. It's indecipherable because it's full of bureaucratic jargon and terms that, ordinary people don't kind of use. It's got all these, this whole language associated with the NDIS that you've got to learn. And then when they get this plan, they're like, well, what do I do now? And so there's something called support coordination, which is help to people to put their plans into action. But only about 40% of people who are in the scheme get that support coordination.
Why is that?
Because it's theoretically, the NDIA say, the agency that runs the scheme, says that it's for people who have more complex cases. But what people tell us at the forums is that this is a whole new thing and it's a big deal. It's a big deal to make this big transition. And so whether you are somebody who got some service before or whether you're completely new and never had any services before, it's a really big deal to make this really big jump. And so what people are telling us in the forums is that they reckon everybody needs someone to give them a hand in the first year, maybe 2 years of the scheme to get used to it and make sure that you make the most of it. But that's not the way it's structured at the moment. So only about 40% of people get a support coordinator. And the rest of are supposed to get help from something that's called a local area coordinator, an LAC. But they're also the people who are doing the planning at the moment. And the scheme's already behind. We're behind in the number of people who are coming into the scheme. And so those local area coordinators, those LACs, are so busy trying to get plans done and get bums on seats and get people through the scheme that they haven't got time on the other end to help people put their plans in action. And so people are really feeling, and I'm probably a good example, my daughter's plan, she got a plan about a month, 6 weeks ago. It just showed up in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea, and so that's okay for us because, you know, I know what to do next. But if you're somebody who isn't and that thing shows up in the mail, it's like, what do I do? What do I do now? Mm-hmm. Like, what do I do? And so at the moment, we've got this really terrible situation where people aren't spending all of the funds that they've been allocated in their plans. And one of the reasons they're doing that is not because they don't need it, yeah. Because they're just sitting there going, what am I going to do now? You know, and so people really strongly tell us that if we're really to make the most of the opportunities presented by the NDIS, people have got to get some help to get their plans into action and get going.
And if people say that you're not happy with your plan, you can go to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal and get everything reviewed. How cumbersome is that process?
Well, at the moment, the review process is another thing that people tell us isn't working at the community forums we're holding. And there's probably a couple of reasons for that. The first is that they're behind bringing in people into the scheme, but they're also behind in dealing with reviews. And in actual fact, there's no time frame for reviews. So there's lots of time frames in the NDIS Act that the National Disability Insurance Agency has to abide by. But reviews isn't one of them.
Well, I thought you had to have a review. You had a review every year?
Yeah, so there's two different kinds of reviews.
Okay.
And so that's probably a good pick-up, Larissa.
Yes.
So the first kind of review is that if you're not happy with a decision that's been made by the NDIA,
yeah.
So what you do is you ask for a review of that. And because there's no time frames for that, you can ask for a review, but actually they're taking months and months and months. And so in actual fact, you can wait so long that you come up to the second type of review, which is at the moment everybody's plans are reviewed annually.
Mm.
And so if you've waited a really long time, if you've, you say you disagree with a decision that the agency has made and you've asked for a review, and that is called a review of a reviewable decision. This is how complicated.
Oh, earlier on the show we had a guest, Nicole Lee, and she actually was talking about the issue of family violence and the problems of the NDIS there, that if you need to leave your partner because it's an abusive relationship, you obviously will need a review because you might be leaving the suburb and you're leaving your supports and that is really problematic because the review might not happen for
yeah.
so long
yeah.
and you're stuck.
Yeah.
And that's why people get stuck in abusive relationships.
Yeah, and also get stuck there. If you've asked for a review because you didn't get sufficient funding for something that you really needed, you're left with this kind of devil in the deep blue sea choice, which is one is you should keep spending the funding because you need it, right? And so you need whatever it might be. It might be personal care to get you out of bed in the morning or somebody to give you a shower or something like that. And so you spend it. But if the review doesn't happen in time, you'll run out of money. So you're kind of left with this choice, which is, will I eke it out because I think the review is going to take me a really long time, or will I spend it like I really need it to demonstrate that I really need it, and then I'll run out. So it's like, it's a terrible choice to kind of have to make. And so, yes, if you're waiting a really long time for a review, and then by the time it, you know, happens, it's time for your second or third plan or wherever you're up to in the kind of planning process.
And then if you've eked it out, it looks like you don't need very much.
Yeah, and so then you've got to go in and make a really, again, you've got to talk to the LAC or the planner and make a really good, strong case about why. But to be honest, the other is also happening more is that people aren't spending all of their NDIS funds because it's so hard to get it kind of up and running. And then when they're going into meetings, they're having to, and their review meetings, they're having to explain why they didn't use all of their funds. And we're hearing some terrible stories about people who are having their plans cut, and that's not what we want to, what we want to see.
So just a couple of last questions from me. Is there a balancing? Is there a balance between the NDIA faces between the needs of the person with the disability or the NDIS participant and service providers?
Well, that's a good question, Finn. I think this is a big adjustment for everybody to make. It's a really big adjustment for people with disability and their families. And one thing we don't want to lose sight of is that there's just a shade over 200,000 people in the scheme. It's just clicked over just recently. And 60,000 of those people are people who never got support before. And so for that group of people, this is a really big change because they've never had support before. They've never been able to go out and think about what it is they need and what it is that they want to do and then use their funding to do, to do that. And so that it's a big change for them. But for the rest of the people, they most of the time they didn't get enough. So now it's about, using the funds in a way that's, they're used to kind of eking it out and now they don't have to. So we had a guy come to our forum just last week in Melbourne and say, he had a hearing impairment and he used Auslan interpreters. And because he was used to eking it out and using them as little as possible so that he could kind of get through the year, he said that the change in mindset was really difficult for him because he was like, oh, I don't have to do that kind of anymore. And he found, for the first little while in his plan, he kept doing it and he wasn't using the funds in his plan until someone said to him, that's what that's there for. You can use it now. And so then he was like, So it's a big shift for people who haven't had support before, and it's a big shift for people who've had little bits of support before who are now have to get their heads around, using it something differently. And then on the other side, it is a really big shift for service providers. And if there's a couple of ways that it's a really big change for them. The first is they're used to getting their money up front from the state government. Then they had to decide how to spend it and who to spend it with. But they got it up front and it was a guaranteed amount of money. Now they get paid in arrears, which means they get paid after they've delivered the service, and they get paid on an individual basis. So they get paid for Finn and for Larissa and for Kirsten, not a guaranteed amount of money. And so that's a big imagine all of their systems and processes and everything like that, that all has to change. But their mindset all has to change. Their mindset now has to change to, what does Finn want? What does Larissa want? What does Kirsten want? And they have to refocus. And that is a big shift. And some of them have been more successful than others in making that change.
So just finally, Larissa, Kirsten, that's your name. Where can people go to? Where can people go to find out more about Every Australian Counts or about the NDIS generally? And two questions: is there any more NDIS Make It Work forums happening in Melbourne or regional Victoria?
Not for this year. We held the last one last week in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, but we are planning some more for next year. So what people should do is go to the Every Australian Counts website, everyaustraliancounts.com.au, and you can find out more about the forums. And we've got a lot of information on our website about the NDIS process, you know, how it works and what can you expect. So people are most welcome to check that out. I always tell people that the source of truth, if they want to know, there's plenty of misinformation out there. There is lots of good information on the ndis.gov.au website, but it's really hard to search and it's really hard to navigate. So the right answers are there. It's just sometimes really hard to find them.
Okay.
Fantastic. So thanks for coming in, Kirsten. Kirsten is the campaign director at Every Australian Counts. We'll be back after this song. Hello, and we're back. It is 8:24. It is Disability Day Breakfast 3CR. Remember, 12 hours of disability content. Now we've got some...
I just want to backtrack. That last song was by Eliza Hull, who is an amazing and lovely woman who's a disabled woman. And I just read recently on Facebook that she has voted number within the top 100 of influential music women in the world or something.
Fantastic. There's a lot of music, great music women in the world. If you're in the top 100, you're doing well. Segueing smoothly, there is some disability events that we should plug today, I reckon.
Sure, because it's International Day of People with a Disability.
Yes. Seamless. You've got an event happening with Carly Finlay you want to talk about.
Oh, yeah. Tonight, Carly Finlay is speaking at the Kathleen Syme Library, which is the library up in Carlton in Faraday Street, and she's talking about amplifying voices and about the importance of empowering disabled people to tell their stories and to work in sustainable creative careers. Gee, I'd love to have one of those.
The life of visual artists isn't sustainable or creative enough for
you? It might be creative. I don't know about sustainable. So that's on tonight, 6 p.m.
All right. So my events, we've got the Sport, Disability Sport and Recreation Festival happening at 10 o'clock. From 10 o'clock today, featuring some, I think there's 30 activities you can try. There's activity zones. You can meet Paralympians that play sports. You can have a go at inclusive sports yourself. It's going to be a great day. It's at Crown River Walk. You can get there by tram, train and everything else. To find out more about the event, you can go to the DSR website, which is dsr.org.au. Now, I also have here...
Is that the one that's one called What Makes You You?
No.
Oh,
You can talk about that.
If you pass me the piece of paper. What Makes You You is on... don't know much about this one, but it's on the 7th of December, which is later on this week, at the Phoenix Park Community Centre in Malvern East, and it's put on by the City of Stonington, and it looks quite interesting.
I think that's on December the 7th, isn't it?
Yep. Mm. Exploring the question, what makes you you? They're looking for people to tell your personal story through audio or visual media.
Fantastic. So the last event we just wanted to talk about, and maybe the most important, because the City of Yarra is proudly helping us bring you the 12-hour Disability Day broadcast. The City of Yarra is holding an event between 10:30 and 12:30 today with special guest speakers and a panel selected by industry professional volunteers and people with disabilities. The speakers will talk about the achievements of people with disabilities and how to ensure inclusion and equity within the City of Yarra. They're also launching their access and inclusion strategy at this event, which will be of particular interest to our local listeners. So if you have the opportunity, go down and check it out. Well, I think that's all for the... If you want to find out more about any events happening for IPDW, check out ipdw.com.au. That's ipdw.com.au. Finally, Naomi, what can people... What highlights are in the Disability Day broadcast?
So I want to say there's a really amazing documentary show coming up at 9 a.m. called Direct Action Worldwide Disability Activism in 2019. So this is produced by Helen Gwilliam, who has done the Disability Day broadcast before, and she's done a really good job of just collecting stories from around the world of protests that have happened in the last year. I want to do a shout-out to Billabong Beats. So regular listeners will be familiar with this show very possibly. It's usually focused on Aboriginal rights, and today it's going to be focused on the NDIS and the Stolen Generation and services that are needed and provided there.
So when's that on?
That will be on at 11 a.m. And I want to give a shout-out also to Are You Looking At Me?, which is by Liz Wright. She's also done a bit of an unusual documentary called Words from the Wise, where she's spoken to older people with disabilities about the advice that they have and what they've learned and what they went through in protests and things, establishing disability rights.
Fantastic. Should just also quickly say that we've had listener feedbacks saying that they would like some support with where to go with their NDIS plan. Kirsten Dean will stay behind and answer your questions. I assume she'll get back to you herself or some such. Anyway, we must get out of here. Thank you, Larissa. Thank you, Naomi. And it's time now for our next show, which is all about disability and parenthood, with Nicole Smith, Jackie Brown, and Elvira Alec.